Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Are you
good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, giving you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Friday, May 29th, 2015. Good afternoon, Al.
Well, Melody, we've got a little bit of a squeaky connection. I think Frank is going to have to...
Well, I'll see how the program goes, but gold today was up a little bit today. We had a $1.80 gain on gold at $11.90.60. Silver's up 0.02 at $16.97. Platinum was down 3 at $11.16. And palladium was down 8 at $780. The USD today is down. The USDX is up 0.02, 96.90. Crude oil was up 2.5 at 68.22, back to 60. Looks like it likes that number in the paper markets. A little pressure on those numbers, but nothing too drastic. We have the. Let me get to my paper numbers here. I clicked on the wrong one, Al. The Dow was down 114 points, 18,011. The NASDAQ was down 27 at 5,070. The S&P was down 13, 2107. 10-year yield, 2.09. And the euro, 1.10, up 0.19. U.S. economy came out today, Al. They revised the GDP once again. Shrank at a 0.7% annual rate in the first 3 months of the year. And, of course, you have a multiple selection of the answer as to why. Severe winter for A, severe winter for B, and severe winter for C. Which is it, Al?
Well, it's a severe winter. It's traditional. It's kind of like a post-Christmas season. We go into Christmas, and we're supposed to spend a bunch of stuff, and then for the first quarter, they kind of report that didn't work out all that well. It's a little bit like, I don't know, reporting that the economists got lumps of coal in their stocking rather than good economic news.
Well, the government's revised estimate for the last quarter was weaker. than the initial estimate of the growth that they had. The U.S. trade gap, the difference between the value of exports and the larger value of imports, was found to be wider than first estimated. They also came out, consumer spending was slower than previously thought, but continue to confirm that there were steady job gains and are expected to fuel a modest, healthy growth for the rest of 2015. I think I'll highlight that and hang it on my wall just to see how healthy this economy is at the end of 2015. So home sales and construction, they rebounded a little bit along with business investment, but nothing too drastically there. And the strong dollar, again, makes the U.S. exports more expensive. Consumers spent less on mobile phone services, among other expenses, than first estimated also. And, of course, they blame the cut in drilling activity by these energy companies and, of course, from the drop price in oil over the past year. And the average U.S. pump price reached $2.03 a gallon in January. That was the lowest level in 8 years. But today it's back to $2.74. Yes, it was lower than a year ago, but still significantly higher than what it was in January. We also had the
All right. I don't hear anyone else talking, but I'm here right now. Does that mean I'm all by myself? Does anyone know? I'm not absolutely certain what's happening right now, and that's not the first time. It's not. There we go. Now Melody's on the other line. Melody, are you there?
What? Yes. Am I?
Okay.
Yes. Consumers. Well, I'm in the middle of a report, and I don't know what's going on with these phones. So let's just continue. I'm assuming we're on the air.
Well, I'm assuming that too, and since I got on, and there was no sound. I didn't hear anything from you or from Frank or anyone else, and I was all by myself, and I was afraid, Melody. I was ready to burst out in tears because I was all alone, and you can understand my concern.
I was talking about the University of Michigan saying that its consumer sentiment dropped to 90.7 from 95.9 in April. This is the lowest since November. And people were gloomier this month than about economic conditions and the future, as they should be. They should be a whole lot more gloomier than 90.7. That should probably read about 49.8. But certainly there was another consumer confidence index out by the conference board. And, of course, that showed an improvement. So, again, two conflicting reports, but I do believe the University of Michigan is the one that is followed a little more closely.
Why don't you go ahead and disconnect now and see if you can reconnect. And I've got an article there. I'll start talking. And you can reconnect and you can come back. Is that all right with you?
Fine.
Okay. Good. Got an article here from Business Insider. And Cordy, it was written earlier today, this morning. And it says, get ready for some depressing news about the U.S. economy. And it says, we're about to get some terrible news on the U.S. economy, sort of. On Friday at 8:30 a.m., this article was written before 8:30. They anticipated what the Bureau of Economic Analysis would release in its second estimate of the first quarter gross domestic product. At the time, they said it is expected that the economy will contract about 0.8% in the first quarter. Now, they'd reported originally that the economy grew by 0.2%. Now they think it's going to be corrected to 0.8%. And in fact, when the morning report was released, 8:30, it turns out they say it's a minus 0.7%, 0.7%. If we have two consecutive quarters of contraction, we'll be officially back in a recession. Now, my guess is that the central planners in Washington, D.C., are ready to work. They're already hard at work trying to cook the books for the second quarter to show that we've had positive growth this quarter, and we don't have two consecutive quarters of bad news. because that means we're in a recession, and that means there's no recovery. Now, this reminds me, some of you may recall, but last year, the first quarter was down. I don't remember. I think it was like 4.5%. Maybe it was I don't remember how far it was down. I don't think it was down that much, but the second quarter came smoking back. And I think the second quarter was allegedly up 4.5%. So it averaged out that it wasn't a bad deal and we weren't going to have a bad year. But the first quarter was so bad that if we didn't have a dramatic improvement in one or two or three of the subsequent quarters, the year would have wound up negative. So we're left to wonder, you know, are we seeing another, is this another incident like that? The numbers aren't as extreme, aren't as large as they were last year in the first quarter. But I'm not going to be surprised if the government cooks the books in order to offset any evidence we might see that we were, you know, say, okay, we're in a recession. We were not in a recession. We had the gross domestic product shrank by 0.8% or 0.7% the first quarter. It'll come up by 2% in the second quarter or who knows what. And the question is, are we seeing legitimate numbers? You know, they can't falsify numbers completely. They don't just pull the numbers out of a hat. And, you know, it's not done, really. We talk about sometimes they pick up the numbers. The economic indicators are selected by means of darts thrown at a board at about 50 yards. And we see where they land, and that'll be our number. That's an exaggeration. That's not the way it works. But they have to maintain some semblance of reality. If the real unemployment rate is 10%, they might be able to tell us that it's 5%, but they can't tell us that it's 1% or 2%. We understand there are too many things, the numbers, there are other contradictions out there. All right? And the lies can't be enormous, but they can be persistent. Now, the question is, are we being lied to? Are we not being lied to? I don't know. It's one of those things we can watch for. But in any case, we've got one quarter with a contraction. There's chief U.S. economist for Deutsche Bank, man by the name of Joe Lavagna. He expected that today's reading would show the economy contracted 1% to start the year. Lavagna, though, thinks that the Bureau of Economic Analysis seasonal adjustment procedures are overstating the economy's weakness. He thinks their formula is wrong. But he thinks they're overstating the economy's weakness during the first quarter. And that's odd to me. I guess he thinks their seasonal adjustment is inaccurate. I didn't think that's the way it's working. He doesn't think it's inaccurate and it's throwing things, it's overstating the weakness because of the winter time and whatever. He doesn't say that, but that's apparently what he thinks, because he says during the first quarter we have the problem, and he implies we don't have a problem in the second quarter or the third quarter or the fourth quarter. It's only the first quarter. Now, there might be some truth to that. That might be a viable explanation, but it's a little hard for me to believe. Nevertheless, as a result, Lavagna argues that we should perhaps focus on gross domestic income. See, we focus on gross domestic product, and he says, no, forget that. Forget that. We'll get a more accurate reading if we focus on gross domestic income, the GDI, rather than the GDP. And we should focus on it as an alternative measure of the economy's underlying strength. And I look at that, and I think that doesn't make good sense to me. We've been relying on GDP for decades. When we have to start changing the numbers, changing the formula, looking, we need a different measurement. This measurement is not giving us good measurements. We need a different measurement, a new and improved measurement. To me, that sounds more like they're cooking the books rather than adjusting, just compensating for a mistake. Now, I'm not saying that it's necessarily true that they're cooking the books, but I am saying that it's the sort of It is a reasonable suspicion. Right? And we live in a world where things have become so bizarre that it's not unreasonable to have these suspicions. There is increasing evidence, and it's just rising. I've written a couple of little articles on the idea that nobody's in control of the economy. And the case for that, the evidence for that, we see more and more people. I picked up a couple more articles today where people on Wall Street are essentially saying the same thing. Nobody knows what's really going on. And in the midst of that confusion, we lose confidence, we lose trust, we become suspicious. We don't know if it's true that the Fed doesn't really know what's going on and the government doesn't really know what's going on because they can't control what's going on. Then who do we trust to control the economy? And the answer may be the free market. You know, Adam Smith, the author of The Wealth of Nations, which is the first major text on economics published in AD 1776. He postulated that there was what he called an invisible hand that guided the markets and pushed them into a direction where they achieved a kind of balance between supply and demand, and it was the most efficient mechanism. Now, if you have that free market, it may be an efficient mechanism, but it's also an unruly mechanism. Markets can suddenly go up. They can suddenly go down. Free markets can move in ways that are, you know, hard to understand, hard to anticipate at times. But still, they seem to get to the right answer, or at least that's the way it always seems to me. But Adam Smith, he argued in favor that there was an invisible hand that guided the market. And what I'm saying is that for a century now, we've had a visible hand, not an invisible hand, a visible hand that has been guiding, controlling, manipulating the markets. And some people say, oh, this idea that the markets are being manipulated, it's just a conspiracy theory. But the truth is the Federal Reserve has been around here since 1913. And part of its mandate was to keep inflation low, and to work to achieve full employment. What does that mean? It means they've been manipulating the economy. It means they have been manipulating the markets in order to achieve low unemployment and low rates of inflation. The manipulation has been here since 1913. That's over a century. Might have been 87, but I'm not sure if that's true or false. Under the Reagan administration, they started what came to be called the Plunge Protection Team. And the Plunge Protection Team was intended to protect us from the markets suddenly falling. There was a sudden drop in the markets. And they had one at Black September, and based on that, the Reagan administration said, we can't afford to have all the markets plunge hundreds of points all of a sudden. So they created this Plunge Protection Team, which protected all of us from sudden and dramatic declines in the whatever remained of the free market. Right? And everybody said, yay! But the truth of the matter is, we have been manipulating the market. The Plunge Protection Team has been manipulating the market to avoid the sudden falls that we might otherwise have experienced in the stock markets. We can say the manipulation is good, we can say it's bad, we can look at it 100 different ways if we care to, but the fact remains that we have been manipulating the market. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's been going on by the Federal Reserve for over a century. It's been going on by the Plunge Protection Team something like 27 years now, if I recall correctly. So market manipulation, it's not a fantastic idea. It's not a conspiracy theory in the sense that we can sit back and say, oh, that's crazy talk. No, that's what's been going on. If we are now at a point where the Federal Reserve and federal government are no longer capable of effectively manipulating and controlling the market, what is going to happen? We'll talk more about that when we return in a couple of minutes. We're going to take a break for some commercials, and Melody will and I will be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Greeks thought thyme herb provided strength. Indeed, the chemical compounds of thyme contain antioxidants, an effective germicide that kills whooping cough bacteria and makes breathing easier. Just imagine what you can do with thyme herb when it comes to respiratory ailments like croup, pneumonia, asthma, and sinusitis. The extra benefit of thyme herb is that it soothes the nerves and stops spasmodic coughing, so you can get some rest. Who says you don't have time to take care of yourself? Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free for Thyme Tincture NT to soothe your cough and get some rest. 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International 704-875-8010 or online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adusk. I'm here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival, and the program's brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. What else have we got here? You know, I was talking in the first part of the program, finished up with the idea that I'm seeing more evidence of people are beginning to, you know, I've been poking at this idea for about a month now that nobody's in control, and I'm seeing more and more people, articles from people and heavy hitters on Wall Street, and they're essentially saying the same thing. For example, or in this case, it's not Wall Street, but here's the headlines from Newsmax.com. Fed's Williams, monetary policy not the tool for preventing crises. A Federal Reserve official on Thursday dove into the simmering global debate over how best to protect against future financial crises, arguing that interest rates hikes are not the answer, even as a last resort. Now, who's this coming from? It's coming from San Francisco Federal Reserve President John Williams. Now, he's telling people, he's saying, look, interest rates are not the answer to solve our problems. But interest rates are almost all the Federal Reserve can do right now to try to solve our problems. We have the Federal Reserve is responsible for monetary policy. We have the federal government is responsible for fiscal policy. What Mr. Williams is essentially saying is that, and most of what monetary policy used to involve, both the interest rates and the monetary supply. And all of this has become confused, and it doesn't work anymore because we are entangled in digital currency. And I think that may be the explanation for why the economy is no longer in control. And here we have a president of the Federal San Francisco Federal Reserve Branch, and he's saying, despite the clear need to consider all potential tools to avoid a financial crisis, I am unconvinced that monetary policy is one of them. Monetary policy is the Federal Reserve's business. That's their fundamental business, and he said, I don't think so. I don't think that's real life. This is one of the presidents of the Federal Reserve Banks. What this implies is he's saying, look, monetary policy no longer works. Why? I've seen other articles, and I've written one on it that'll be published in this next issue of American Survival Melody's newsletter. Where they point out that they trace this back, because they say, well, if you've got a fiat currency and fractional reserve banking and Federal Reserve for central bank, somebody's got to be in control, and they've got to make the calls on what's happening to the money. What I'm beginning to strongly suspect is that no one can control digital currency. When we had a world with physical currency, gold and silver coins, you can't just send them across an ocean anytime you like. All right? It takes time. It takes days to move coins from New York over to Europe or wherever. Today, with digital currency, you can move it at the speed of light over the internet. And I think the result is this. If the government, where the Federal Reserve has previously relied on adjusting interest rates to make the economy run faster or slower, if they increase interest rates, you can't borrow as much, and that would tend to slow the economy. If they lowered interest rates, people would borrow more, and that would stimulate the economy. But that's the way it worked with physical money. And the reason it did is because the physical money was essentially trapped in this country by the ocean on the Pacific and the ocean on the Atlantic side. The lenders had to pretty much accept whatever number in terms of interest rates that the Federal Reserve handed out. But with digital currency, that's no longer true. If the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, what happens? American lenders just say, we don't want to lend at 1% or 2% when we can get 10% in Africa or South America or someplace. We can make reasonable loans and get a good return on investment. And bang, they push a button on the keyboard and they move $1 million, $1 billion, whatever. And they move it to foreign countries and foreign markets. And my point is that when the Federal Reserve declares, here's the new interest rate, as if they were the kings and queens of the country, the lenders don't have to put up with it. They give us low interest rate, the lenders pull their money out, and they move it to another economy. And the net result is when the Federal Reserve says we're going to cut the interest rate to near zero, what they do is drive money out of the money supply here in the United States. And when that money supply shrinks, guess what? The economy tends to slow. The formula that had the mechanism that had previously been used to stimulate the economy is now slowing the economy. They lower interest rates, and guess what? The economy doesn't move faster. That's what they expected. They are perplexed by it. They're looking at it and they say, oh my gosh, what's going on? It's going on because the money supply is being reduced. Now, the money supply historically involves fiscal policy of the federal government. The federal government is in charge of figuring out how much money to inject into the economy by spending. And in order to spend, one or two things has to take place. Given the federal government doesn't produce any money, it doesn't produce any wealth, it doesn't produce cars, it doesn't produce houses, it doesn't produce corn. If it wants to spend more money and inject more money into the economy, it has to get that money from someplace. And it either gets the money from raising taxes or from borrowing money from lenders. They can't raise taxes because the economy is stagnant. Right now, they can't really do it. I mean, there might be some exceptions, but they can't raise taxes in order to get enough money where, in theory, they can stimulate the economy, because the only place they're going to take the money out of the economy, keep a bunch of it for themselves, and then use the rest of it to allegedly stimulate the economy. It just doesn't work. You can't raise taxes during a recession and expect to stimulate the economy. Okay, we can't raise taxes, so we'll borrow. All right, great idea. We'll borrow funds. Now, that wouldn't be such a bad idea, provided that lenders were still willing to lend to you. And in the world where we are today, lenders are reluctant to lend to the United States. I won't say none of them do it, but the number of lenders willing to lend to the United States is dramatically reduced because, one, the interest rate we're paying is down near zero, or at least influenced by the near zero interest rate that the Fed issues, and lenders are saying, what do I want? I want to lend my money to the government and make almost nothing on it? I'll lend my money to Zimbabwe. They at least pay a decent rate of return. On top of which, our government is so deeply in debt, a lot of people think it can never pay the existing debt that it has. And therefore, to lend more is essentially to give your money away. You're not going to get paid back, at least not paid in full. So the government is left to sell its bonds to the Federal Reserve. It's the lender of last resort. They'll buy the government's bonds because virtually no one else wants to. And what I'm trying to illustrate is that the government cannot effectively borrow money, and it can't raise taxes to a significant degree. And therefore, the government doesn't have the means, the fiscal means, to inject more money into the economy and stimulate the economy. Federal government can't use fiscal policy in a way to stimulate the economy. Federal Reserve can't use monetary policy in a way to stimulate the economy. And so the economy has just dragged on since 2007, 2008, and it's been fairly stagnant. It hasn't collapsed, but it hasn't recovered. Huh? It's evidence that all of their efforts to stimulate the economy, the most you can say is the economy did not collapse. And that's a good thing. It may be a great thing, but it hasn't grown significantly. And the point is that all of the efforts and the mechanisms that they've been able to use historically don't appear to work anymore. And if they don't, that means that the Federal Reserve and federal government are no longer in control of the economy. And that is a strange situation. It may be cause for celebration. If they can't control the economy, we may be back into a true free market, or at least headed in that direction. And from my perspective, that's cause for celebration. I mean, in theory, I say, yay, hooray for the free market. But that free market can move like a ping pong ball. If what I'm suggesting here is roughly correct, it means plunge protection team isn't going to protect you anymore. They can't. They can't protect us to the extent they have in the past. The market could fall. It's entirely conceivable. Some people have argued that the Dow Jones, for example, is going to drop from 18,000 down to 4,000. I don't argue that point. I have no idea. I don't know that it can drop that far or will drop that. I'm not making that argument. But some people who are credible have made the argument. And if we are back in a free market, there's no plunge protection team to stop that from happening. Or at least we're reaching a point where the plunge protection team's ability to stop those kinds of declines, it's nowhere near as strong as it was 5, 10, 20 years ago. So, point I'm trying to get to is, again, we have San Francisco Fed President John Williams. He's essentially saying, look, the Fed doesn't have the tools to handle the economy. All right? And, well, you've got another one here. Another article from, I'm scrolling up to get to the top of this thing, Star Mutual Fund Manager John Hussman, president of Hussman Investment Trust. He writes that the Fed has created a third financial bubble in 15 years, and he goes on down, and he complains that the government, he says, we can no longer, there seems to be a perception that the central bankers are gods, or at the very least minor deities in some twisted economic pantheon. But he goes on, coupled with the deification of central bankers is a faith that interest rates are a panacea. Whatever the problem, interest rates can solve it. Interest rates are controlled by the Federal Reserve. Here we have another author, a significant figure, who's coming out and saying, no, I don't think interest rates can control things anymore. And I'm telling you, I'm arguing the same thing. I've been arguing, you know, talking about it for a month off and on, and reaching the point of awareness, nobody's in control. So what's going to happen, Melody, if no one is in control? What's going to happen if the stock market, the Dow Jones, falls to 4,000? No one's in control. Let's suppose that were true in the Dow, and we're going to get free market. We're going to get truth out of the free market, not government lies, not, you know, tell me sweet, sweet lies and rest of that sort of thing. Government, we're going to see truth, and the Dow falls to 4,000, and the price of gold goes to $10,000 an ounce. Let's suppose that happened. I don't know that that's the truth, but it is conceivable that this could happen in a true free market. How well can the public absorb those truths? You know, we're back to A Few Good Men, the movie. 1992 or thereabouts, where Jack Nicholson played Nathan Jessup, a Marine colonel who was in charge of Guantanamo, and Tom Cruise is the young hero, Navy defense attorney, and one thing leads to another, and Jessup is on the stand, Colonel Jessup is on the stand, and he says, the truth, you can't handle the truth. Well, can we? I mean, we're going to have an opportunity. If no one is in control of the economy, the free market truth is likely to break out. And if it does, who can handle it? As much as I want to cheer for the free market, I sit back and look at this and say, oh, you know, beware of what you wish for. Maybe we're going to get that free market because no one is still in control. What do you think, Melody?
I know we've said for years and years and years you would see the Dow and the gold cross at 3,000. Although when we started coming to those numbers, you didn't have the Dow at 18,000. So I think mm-hmm. you're going to have a higher gold price, probably at 5,000, and the Dow will be at 5,000. So we certainly, and it's not a matter of whether people can absorb the truth. Can they absorb the losses? And no, people can't. Are they prepared for those losses when they seek the truth and or find the truth, or when the truth is staring them in the face? And people really don't want to know the truth, Al. I know there's, you know, a lot of people seek the truth, and but they really don't. It's difficult to find the truth, and
it's not so difficult to find it, but it's difficult to face it.
You'd be
it
surprised.
Takes courage to face the truth. We complain that information is being concealed in one thing or another, and there's certainly, and it is to some extent, but even when we find the truth, a lot of us lack the courage to face it. Oh, that can't possibly be. We're seeing evidence that nobody is in control of the economy. And it's not just my idea. We're seeing evidence from half a dozen different sources that I've seen in the last week, where they're essentially saying the same thing. What does that mean, and how long can the economy continue without any control, without doing something that's going to surprise a lot of people and maybe be adverse to their seeming best interests? What do you do?
But you
I'd say, and I see, and I'm tracing the source of this to fiat currency, to digital currency, not just fiat currency, but digital currency. And what's the opposite of digital currency? Physical. Gold, silver. Maybe now's the time to get into gold and silver. Where are we right now? Let's take a break, a couple more commercials, and we will be back in a moment on Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
A heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
I'm Alfred Addisk here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival, and I believe we still have a caller. Joe from Arkansas is still waiting patiently on the line. Are you there, Joe?
I'm here, yeah.
What you got for
us? I wanted to put in my 2 cents on this thing that you're talking about, and, you know, besides the interest rate.
Wait a second. Let's be clear about this 2 cents. Will you accept a check?
Yeah, I will.
All right, go ahead then.
Okay. Okay, besides the low interest rate driving lenders to lend their money overseas instead of in this country, I would think that another reason why these stimulus programs, you know, don't stimulate the economy anymore is that it used to be that Americans mostly did business with each other. So when they put some stimulus money into the economy, one American would spend it with another American who would spend it with another American, and it would circulate inside the country and stimulate the economy. And now I would think that as soon as they put in some stimulus money into the economy, you know, whoever gets it goes to Walmart and buys something from China, and the money goes to China, and doesn't circulate inside the country, so the economy doesn't get stimulated very much. So
I agree with you.
That's another big reason why the economy doesn't get stimulated by the stimulus money anymore.
Are you familiar with the concept of a multiplier effect when money comes into a local economy and you get more bang for your buck than people might suppose? Are you familiar with the multiplier effect?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I suppose it works in reverse, too.
It has
if
to.
If the money goes
to
China,
to.
Then instead
That's
of
exactly
circulating
right.
seven times inside the country to create $7 worth of income for every dollar spent, you know, the money goes outside of the country and thus deprives the economy. You know, when we
That's
have a
exactly
$500 billion a year trade deficit, I would think that that deprives the economy, basically, of $3.5 trillion worth of income because we don't get the multiplier effect of that money being spent and
it
re-spent inside the country.
It works against us rather than for us. Just so people understand, the multiplier effect is something economists debate in terms of magnitude, but they all seem to agree that it exists. And in broad strokes, what it means is that if they have the National Firemen's Convention in Dallas, Texas this year, and a fireman comes down here from Chicago, and he comes to the National Convention, and he spends $1,000 in Dallas. Well, that's Dallas gets $1,000, and that's the way people look at it. But economists actually know it's more than that. When he spends that $1,000 in Dallas, the net result is that Dallas gets the equivalent of somewhere between $3,000 and $7,000 in economic stimulus. There is a kind of multiplier effect where you bring it in, the economy does far more than just $1,000 you see. There's much more that happens to the economy. But it has to be that if we take $1,000 out of the Chicago economy and bring it down to Dallas, and Dallas gets, say, $5,000 in economic stimulus, it has to be that Chicago suffered a $5,000 loss when the fireman brought his $1,000 down to spend at the Dallas convention. And the same thing has to, and if it weren't true, then we would have a perpetual money machine. He brings $1,000 to Dallas, we get $5,000 worth of positive effect. We send $5,000 to San Diego, they get $25,000 in positive effect. They send the $25,000 to Seattle, they get $125,000 in positive effect. They send the $125,000 back to Chicago, and Chicago gets something, I don't know, $600,000 in positive effect, which all started with the first $1,000. In Chicago, moving to Dallas, and so on. It has to be. It can't be that way. We can't just multiply it endlessly. If it's you get a multiplier effect where the dollars wind up, you get a multiplied loss where the dollars came from, and that's what we're trying to. That's what we're playing with here. That's the idea we're talking about. If where our money is going to China, China is getting $3 to $7 worth of economic stimulus for every dollar they get out of the United States. And we are suffering a $3 to $7 loss for every loss that we're shipping, for every dollar that we're shipping to foreign countries. So, is there anything else you'd like to add, Joe?
Well, yeah. I read some years ago about quite a brilliant economic thinker who's unfortunately not very well known, named Carl Wilkin, and he connected this multiplier effect with the cycle of production. You know, basically, he had this brilliant insight, I thought, that the economy is not a random process. You know, generally, economists talk about the economy as if it's a random process where, you know, somebody does some farming, somebody makes tools, somebody builds houses, somebody makes clothes, and so on like that, and the money circulates in a random sort of pattern amongst these people. But no, he said that, no, really, there's a step-by-step cycle where first somebody produces raw materials. Then the raw materials are shipped, you know, transported to the factory, and the factory makes them into some kind of finished goods. Then they're transported to the retailer, and the retailer sells some to the ultimate consumer, and so on like that. There's a cycle from production of raw materials, you know, through the various stages of processing and distribution and retailing and wholesaling, you know, until finally the last person in the line buys the stuff that was made from the original raw materials. And then the cycle goes over again, you know, starting with the raw materials, and then it goes through the cycle again and again and again. You know, so the cycle of distribution of income starts with raw materials. And so that if the raw material producer, you know, he said that the economy tended to be depressed, especially when the prices that farmers got were low, because farming was the biggest raw material industry in the country, still is. And so when farmers had low incomes, you know, they didn't have much money to spend with other people further up the line, and those people didn't have much money to spend and sound like that. So the whole economy tended to be depressed. And he found also that in times when farmers got good prices, then they would have a lot of money to spend with the next person up the line, who would have a lot of money to spend with the next person up the line, and so on like that, and the economy would be prosperous. So he had this brilliant insight, I thought, to connect the what he called the velocity of money, the turnover of money, to the cycle of production from raw materials to the last person in line to buy the finished goods.
All right. Did you say the man's name was Carl Wilkins?
Carl Wilkin, yeah.
Wilkin.
Wilkin.
All right, I'm going to try to look him up and see what he had to say about it, because this is an important concept, because it involves forces that are unseen and virtually invisible. They know they're there, or they believe they're there at least, and if they are correct, it explains why you can have a very prosperous farming community, for example. You got a little town, all the farmers go to town to spend their money, to buy plows, whatever it is, as long as they're buying from the local dealers. The guy that sells the plows, another guy sells tractors, another guy sells whatever, corn, that you seed corn, whatever. As long as they keep their money locally, they can be very prosperous because they're growing the crops, they're coming up out of the ground, they're adding to the wealth, you're getting a multiplier effect. That little farm community can do well. But you bring in a big farm corporation, agricultural corporation, and they buy up all the little farms, and they put the farmers to work as managers on the farm. They don't no longer own the farm, but they're the managers. They got a better deal. They got a dental plan. All seems great, but the farm corporation, the agricultural corporation, takes the profits out of the farms, and they move them to their corporate headquarters, which may be in New York City, but it could be 100 different places. My point is, when they extract those profits, the farm community begins to degrade. And nobody knows exactly why, but they can't afford to paint the buildings anymore. They can't seem to buy new cars. And the whole thing starts to wind down. And it's happening, in my opinion, because they allowed this big agricultural corporation to come in and start pulling the profit that used to go to local dealers. And the local dealers spent the profit locally for the most part. And that the system held together. It explains why these little farm towns become ghost towns. And the same thing, in my opinion, applies when you bring in a Walmart. We sit back and say, yay, let's bring in a Walmart. I can get a digital TV for less money than I can get it out of Joe and Sally's TV store down the street. The mom and pop store. They used to charge a higher profit. Higher percentage on those TVs. We can get a better deal out of Walmart. This is great. Yeah, except for one thing. The money going into that Walmart, the profit goes to some other place. The mom and pop TV store, they spent their profits locally. The Walmart store takes the profits out and sends them to the corporate headquarters or wherever they're going. The net result is that Walmart, in my opinion, there will be a multiplier effect. There will be an invisible loss to take the profits out. You multiply it how much? 3-5 times. And next thing you know, your community begins to degrade. Walmart is not a source of wealth per se. We are seduced by low prices and we don't realize you got to do business locally. You've got to buy, you got to pay the premium to Joe and Sally's TV store. And they, yeah, Walmart will give you a better deal, but Joe and Sally spend the money in the local community. Your community will blossom, flourish, prosper. You do business with Walmart, not so much. All right? So it's a complex idea. It's hard to explain, but what we're trying to get across is there's more to it than just low prices. And that's what everybody looks for. We're all looking for low prices, low prices, low prices. There's more to it. If that's all you can see in your economy and you are doing low prices with a corporation from out of state, out of country, they're going to generate a multiplied gain and you're going to suffer a multiplied, although invisible, loss. And people say, what happened? It used to be a bright and shiny place and now it's kind of ground down. Does that make any sense, Joe? Do you understand where I'm? I think you do.
Oh, yeah. It makes absolute sense. I think another example of that might be, suppose you have a city where there's 100 blacksmiths, making tools.
Yep.
And so, they're all independent tool makers. And so when people want to buy steel tools, you know, they go to these blacksmiths and buy their knives and their hoes and their shovels and whatever it is that they want. And so the money circulates in that city that way. And now here's a guy comes and starts a tool factory. And instead of having 100 independent blacksmiths, you know, each making, you know, a profit from their work, now they're all working for this guy that owns the tool factory. And so he pays them, you know, they've got job security now. And they don't have to do the books and things like that, but they get kind of a low wage, and the tools sell, and you know the production is more efficient, and the tools sell for less. But the corporation, you know, the CEOs of the corporation, you know, take the profit, and you know the blacksmiths, the people working at the factory, don't get much money. And so so one guy gets very rich, and 100 other guys, you know, get a lot poorer. So overall, I think the community is more impoverished because of it.
I don't know. I don't complain about the corporate executive or whoever the corporation owner getting rich. That doesn't bother me, provided that he's spending his money and investing his profits in the local community. But when you start pulling that money out of the community, we do have a trade deficit, for example, between ourselves and China. If our trade with China is even, I don't have a problem with it. They send us $1,000 worth of stuff, we send them $1,000. But when we go into these trade deficits, that's where you get your multiplier effect. They're getting power off this trade deficit. They are empowered by capturing those dollars and getting the benefit of the multiplier effect. And that same trade deficit is brutalizing the American people, although it's doing it in a way that is invisible and not apparent. But it's been done by means of this peculiar concept of the multiplier effect. So for me, as long as it's fair, 1,000 in and 1,000 out, okay, I don't have a problem. But if it's 1,000 in, that's why people like tourists. That's why they fight for the tourist business, because tourists come down. They come from Chicago. They're coming to Dallas. They're spending money down. We're not going to Chicago to spend money in Chicago, but Chicago's coming down here. We make a killing off that. Right? People want that tourist business. Because they're not sending tourists back up there, and there's a problem. That multiplier effect, you know, if you can't really engage in equal trade, dollar for dollar, they spend $1,000 in Dallas, we spend $1,000 up in Chicago. Good, no problem. Everybody gets a benefit, everybody gets a cost. But if one side is spending and the other side is not, we have, you know, there's someone suffering an unseen loss that, if it persists, will drive their country into poverty or their community or whatever. So it's a peculiar theory. It's a sort of thing that's hard to believe, and all I can tell you is that economists do believe it, as Joe was testifying to, essentially, with his comments on here. And we've got, what have we got? About 30 seconds, Joe. Anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, well, the Constitution says that Congress can regulate our foreign trade. And I think whatever, you know, they wanted to create a federal government of limited powers, so whatever limited powers they gave to Congress, I think they expected them to use. So they didn't want free trade. They want Congress to regulate our trade so that we would benefit from it. But instead, Congress has decided to regulate our trade so that we lose from it. You know, we run up a trade deficit instead of at least breaking even.
Yeah, I know. They're hurting us. This country is being taken down, and you can all see it, and you don't know why. This is part of it. It's because we have this invisible multiplier effect, and it can be harmful if you're not aware of it and you don't control it. We're out of time, Joe. I want to thank you for your phone call. Melody and I will be back on Monday. In the meantime, I hope you all have a good weekend. May the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and Joe from Arkansas. Bye-bye.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got to be a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all.
in a